Thank you all for showing up and cheating death on the streets of Bellingham. There must have been a real drive to bring you in tonight, but I'm glad you're here to share this with me. What I'm going to talk about tonight is on the subject of persistence and connection. And I look at the persistence portion of it. It will be kind of a tool to work on the connection portion of it. And I'll be spending quite a bit of time on connections. Persistence is the ability to hang in there with something which is difficult without turning away, and to be willing to simply wait when waiting is called for while taking the long view. And it almost sounds like it's a passive activity, but even the waiting is not at all passive. If you've ever been in a situation when you're waiting for your four-wheel drive pickup truck to show up to get you out of the snow, it's not passive at all. And for those of you in the military, or that were in the military one time or another, you know that more than anybody else. I think the term is hurry up and wait. But stubbornness and persistence are not the same thing. And stubbornness is really a negative. It's a non-thinking, it's angry, it's reactive. When you've seen somebody that is absolutely stubborn, he won't change or she won't change their mind for anything, even though all the causes and conditions change. You know, it's almost like, have you ever seen the, tell it to the hand? It's similar to that. The person is not listening to you. Whereas persistence, on the other hand, as an opposite, is largely based on faith and determination and has its basis in reason. And the reason faith juncture we'll get into a little bit later. But it's based on thinking and responding to what is. If we use persistence, usually persistence is something long term. We're going for some kind of a goal that, if we do what we need to do today, it's still not going to get the long-term goal done. For example, I've got a pickup truck sitting in my garage I've been working on for 28 years. It's persistence. And every day we take a little bit of that and we connect it and hook it up and listen to my wife say, "What did you get done today? Is it running yet? Are we there yet?" But that's by doing that. Have you ever been in a situation where you, for example, being Shusho, and there's a lot of stuff that you have to do, and you look at the whole thing, and it looks a bit scary on the outside, but if you say, "All I have to do is do this amount, read 20 pages, write about what you've read," it all becomes manageable. And even better than that, I find that, at least for me, when I do that, I feel pretty good about the day. I don't have the gnawing feeling that I'm not doing what I need to be doing, but just a little bit. persistence is absolutely essential for Zen practice. Other than Tim, who loves getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I don't know of anybody in the room that probably does. You know, you have to wake up early, long hours on the cushion. And what keeps me doing it is that it's what I need to do to keep my equilibrium. It's a it's basically what I need to do, you know. I meditate, I sit with the Sangha, I feel better, I look at the world differently. That's a really big motivator. Now, do I believe that I'm going to float around the room someday and glow weird colors or become a Buddha? No. But that's not important. What's important is that I do those little steps today and I feel good. And that's what the Buddha was teaching in the first place, wasn't it? How to relieve suffering. And frustration, which is one of my favorites, is the main obstacle to persistence. And frustration is a double-sided entity, positive and negative. On the negative side, anger, usually rejection, to hell with this, I don't need to do this, you know, I'm making myself crazy. And quitting, basically. It's a resignation to events. But on the positive side, frustration can help us attain our goal. I'll give you an example. If you ever are lucky enough to come to my house and come to my garage when I'm working, you will probably hear some of the most colorful language you ever heard in your life. Because I am constantly hitting my thumb with the hammer. Or I used to be able to do something, but I can't do it anymore. There's a lot of frustrations. But I'm used to it. It's part of life. And what it causes me to do, generally, not always, but generally, is to recognize, oh, there's frustration. Step back a little bit, take a look at what I'm doing, try to figure out some way to do it anyway, give it another shot, and usually give... I laugh at myself quite a bit when I'm working on stuff, you know. And it's almost like, you know, oh, there's that frustration again. You know, we should be further along, but we're not. I'm human. But it doesn't stop things from getting done. It's really easy when you're frustrated at anything to say, it's not my fault. It's that guy's fault. Or it's your fault. But not me. And I had a really good tutor at one point that said, if you're pointing your finger at somebody else, and there's one finger pointed at him, and there's three fingers pointed back at you. So the problem is not with him. Guess where the problem is? B- But I do love that. I do love that feeling sometimes, and I still do. It's one of my favorites, that righteous indignation that we can say when we figure that we've been wrong, I'm frustrated, and it's your fault. And I can yell and scream, do all this crazy stuff that I try not to do. But what that's saying is that you are the bad person, I am the good person. You are not as smart as I am. You are not as good as I am. I'm better than you. See where we're going with this? It's an ego thing. And if there is anything that loves to be puffed up, it's our egos. But again, if we look at it and see it for what it is, the usual response is, I should be better than this, and just let it go. It's not important. A quick little story. When I was living on the East Coast, East Coast drivers are pretty notorious for being rude. When I would get on the road to go drive to work, it was like I was girding up for battle every time I'd go to work. Because there'd always be somebody that wants to cut you off or do something really crazy. Well, it was summertime, and it was in Delaware. And there was a construction zone ahead, and there was two lanes going into one. Now, I just come back from Germany, and the Germans, they may drive fast, but they have what's called a zipper law, where one car, they alternate. One car will get in the lane and the other, and it's people just do it. It's the way it's supposed to be. Not that way in the East Coast. So I see, lane is narrowing, get into the appropriate lane. I'm sitting there, and it's got to be 95 degrees, and I don't have air conditioning, and I'm pretty miserable anyway. And all of a sudden, I notice a car passes me on the right. Somewhere. A little bit later, another car. But this time, I think I'm a pretty creative guy. You know, and my mind is a really ingenious place sometimes. Well, I'm thinking, if I just had a handful of nails, you know, I could throw it out in that lane. You know, fix that guy. Another car. And so by this time, well, I've got a welder. And what I really need to do is to weld up some oversized jacks with points on, like little miniature tank tracks. And it wouldn't take me too long to do that. And there's another car. And by this time, I'm really getting into the planning phase of this operation. And I hear a honk. And I look up, and there's a blue station wagon with my best friend, his wife, and his two daughters. And they're waving at me. That's righteous indignation, you know, and that was quite the learning experience, because every time somebody passes me that way now, I think, well, maybe they might be somebody I know that can tell on me. Again, the same rules apply. If you have a question at any point, feel free. It's a small group tonight. And we're talking, the whole book is about maturity, fitting, taking our places, fitting in with others. And where we're persistent, it's not really a boring thing. Good things happen when we're persistent. If I do the same thing over and over again with the same result, that's sanity, right? We've heard that before. If I asked you, tell us, you know, I need my car fixed. Where is a good mechanic? Can you tell me? I can go to Joe's, and he can fix that for me at a pretty good price. I'm taking on your word that Joe's a good mechanic and can help me. So I go to Joe, he fixes my car, and does a good job, and I take it back to Joe two or three times. All of a sudden, I've developed faith based on my experience that Joe's a good mechanic. And that was that faith reason thing I was talking about a little bit ago. That's the kind of faith that really, really means a lot to me. It's faith born on experience and wisdom. If we keep doing those type of things, faith will spring. When people see you doing the same thing over and over again with good results, they will have faith in you that you are a mature person. Might be misplaced, maybe not. After a while, we keep doing that, and we develop confidence in other people. And we all know somebody like that. You know, we can count on this guy when, you know, things really get bad. That guy is the guy you need to go to. He's a mature person. He can help. So that persistence not only spreads from me to Talos, but to everybody in the neighborhood, as they say. And it's a positive thing in being mature. And when we're persistent, like I said earlier, we have to take the long range view. We have to look down the road a little bit, knowing full well that not every time when we do something that we consider wise or noble, it's going to come out the way we think it's going to come out. But the trick is just to keep persevering at that. Because the law of averages are that if you keep doing those constructive things over and over again, the results are going to be beneficial to everybody. So it's kind of like we talk about weather, you know, weather versus climate. Weather today is snowy, you know, but if the climate is getting warmer, I don't know. Climate and weather, short term, long term. And part of Zen practice is the ability to be comfortable standing up with no firm footing. That's kind of where that that faith comes in that we're talking about. The world has a lot of frustration, loss, impermanence, and failure. And the easiest way I've seen to deal with that is just to confront it. Don't run away from it. Recognize it for what it is. And just do the best that you can. We've got a pretty good instruction manual in Buddhism that you can rely on to answer most of those questions and make those skillful choices. And if you think about it, we have a few skiers in here, I'm sure. And back in the day, I used to ski too. But if you think about skiing, what are you doing? You've got two boards strapped to your feet. You're standing on the side of a mountain, usually about 45 degrees, standing on a billion little bitty ice chunks that are just slippery as can be. And we're going to voluntarily put the nose of our skis down the hill and let gravity take over, which we don't have any control over either. And if you think about it from those terms, it's absolutely mind-boggling. It's absolutely scary. But if you have faith in the action, it sure does get, it sure is fun from time to time. Not scary at all. You're not really controlling the outcome either, but it's still fun. You're taking the long range view, thinking about getting down to that lodge and having a toddy or a cup of cider or something like that. And it's good. Sitting from that fireplace. Okay, because of that realization, to be mature, I must be integral. I must be an integral part of society. I know that my happiness depends on the happiness of those around me. Now, does that sink in? Do you believe that? Your happiness depends on the happiness of the people around you? Yeah, this is a pretty good area to check that out, because this is a pretty happy and caring place. I was in an office one time, and I had two groups of people. One group of people that I worked with in Alaska that I really liked, a lot of good friends. And on the other side of this big room was the people I was currently working with, which were East Coast people. I really didn't, it was more of a get him before he gets you type of situation. But I noticed pretty drastically when I walked from one side of the room to the other side of the room and back again. Every time I did that, my mood changed. I would be a little bit happier here and a little less happier here. And that was a real epiphany for me. I mean, it was just like, you know, it was like a test tube experience, if you will, for a sociologist. But I firmly believe that I can only be as happy as the people around me. Thus, I need to help you guys any way I can. And that's maturity. That's also a kind of a start on the bodhisattva way of life too. So they kind of tie in. That's persistence. Do I have any questions? No questions? Okay. I want to talk about connections. The first connection that we make in our lives is with our parents. Seems kind of obvious. We tend to forget that. Sometimes I think I sprung forth fully formed, beloved of whomever. But if we're going to take this journey to maturity, you know, it's almost like a roadmap. You have to have a roadmap to figure out, I'm here and I need to go over here. I'm me here now and I want to be more mature. So it seems to me the first thing we need to do in figuring out where we are is figuring out who we are. And the first portion of that is taking a look at our parents. And Norm spends quite a bit of time, and I think rightly so, on this subject in the chapter. And I think he's absolutely, you know, 100% right in this. Once we begin to understand our connection with and influence of our parents, we can make peace with any pain we have toward them and have a better understanding of why we are the way we are. And that's the plum. Why are we this way? How many people still have living parents? Raise your hand. Okay. Almost all of you. Great. You've got some time to do some of these things. Any anger. Some of us have a problem with the way we were brought up. And we need to address not only how our parents raised us, why we're the way we are. We have some anger issues that we need to deal with as well. And we have to understand that our anger and our attitude toward our parents may have something to do with them as a stimulus, if you will, but mostly they have to do with us. Because it's just like everything else we look at in the world. We look at the world through our eyes, our nose, our ears, and it gets a little bit skewed up when it goes through our heads. So how much is parents and how much is us? And we have to look at that. This is where we need to do our healing, because we're not going to change our parents. There's no way. You know, even when you were 2 years old, and I'm told that's the terrible twos, and that's when kids really start screaming, you probably couldn't do it then. But we need to understand our connection and our influence of our parents if we need to, so we can make peace with them and have a better understanding of why we are the way we are. This is where we need to heal. Even though this work can be painful, you can't do it out of a book. You can maybe do it a little bit with meditation, but it's not a theoretical thing. It's a get your hands dirty thing. And it's tough. It's really hard. It may be a little embarrassing, maybe real emotional. You know, that's life. But it's only when we work with the pain of dealing with our parents that I think we really start growing up. Now, how are we going to do this? The first thing is to talk with them. Talk. Converse. I don't know when the last time you call your mom or your dad or whatever. I'm sure they'd love to hear from you. Maybe not. I don't know. But that's where we have to start. And it takes a long time sometimes to do that because there's so much baggage in the way. But all you're doing is talking to your parents. It's important not to be judgmental or accusatory. All you want to do is, Dad, Mom, what were you like when you grew up? How do you feel about this or that? Both my parents are gone. And I remember reading a book, go figure, on how to do this. Because I really wanted to make the connection, but I really didn't know how. Especially with my dad. Now, I told you in a previous talk that my mom died when I was a freshman in college, and I was halfway across the country when that happened. I wasn't there when she passed. But I was lucky enough, after I graduated from high school, now this is my crazy mother, right? She wanted to go backpacking with her 18-year-old kid, which is pretty radical. And it's also pretty radical that I agreed to it. I don't know what was going through my mind. But it was one of the best things I ever did. If you're familiar with Yosemite, we went up to Tuolumne Meadows, and we hiked up toward Mount Lyell and Mount Baker, Mount Lyell and Mount Ritter. Spent a week. And I think I told her everything that was in my brain about how I felt about her. And she did the same for me. Especially about halfway through it, when I started hiking up toward one of the mountains, I think it was 13,000 feet. And she said, "I'll sit back here." Well, she's a 40-something-year-old woman, no kidding. So about the afternoon, she saw a rescue helicopter flying around the area. And she was absolutely sure that I had taken a fall and broken my neck or something. And I can remember when I was walking back down that trail to camp, through her tears, because she was crying buckets, that just reinforced everything that I think she felt for me, let me know how much she loved me. And there was really nothing else to talk about. So I may not have been there when she passed, but there was nothing left unsaid. And I hope that if you still have parents living, give them a call. Go down there for a weekend. I had a friend of mine in Germany back around 2000, I think it was, and we were talking about she was having trouble with her mom. They hadn't spoken in some time. And I told her that story, and I said, "Why don't you give her a call? You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow." And she said, "Well, the rates are so high, and I don't know if I can afford it." And a couple of days later, I said, "Did you make that call?" And she said, "Yeah." And her mom had died the previous day. That's tough. Talk with them. With my dad, it was a little bit different. And I'll tell you this story because if you know how, sometimes it's as good to know how to do something as what not to do. You learn the same either way. And I can remember with my dad, he was, didn't share very much, very success driven, didn't talk a whole bunch. We were more like buddies, but we never would, he never would open up. Wouldn't talk about World War II, but that was pretty standard. So I found out later that he was in Bastogne during the Bulge. And he should have, that's one thing he told me. I said, "Dad, where'd you get that Purple Heart? And where'd you get shot?" And he said, "In my butt. Because that was the only thing I couldn't get low enough in the foxhole." And that was the only thing he really shared to me. So anyway, he went down. We got him into a place in Santa Barbara. And beautiful little apartment complex for elderly people. Had a pool and a party house and library. And food market was right around the corner. And beautiful place, but he was never really happy with it. You know, he kept saying, well, people don't come up to my standard. They're not quite good enough. I started thinking, well, I think I know where that came from, you know. I tried. And finally, I can remember sitting, the sun was going down over the harbor in Santa Barbara, and I asked him the big question. I said, do you have any life experiences you want to share with me? And he thought about that for a little bit. And he said, I'm so pissed off now, I'm afraid to die. And that was the way we ended the conversation. So you can learn as much from that as you can from the other way. The important thing to do is start the conversation. Don't think it's going to, we can do it next week or next month or, you know, when Johnny gets into school or whatever. Do it whenever you can because you just don't know. And if you're talking to an older person, and I didn't realize it until I started talking with my father a little bit, that they become a little bit more transparent. At least I've noticed that. Because some of the things that they tried to, that were socially unacceptable during their working years, they don't have to hide it anymore. So I found out that a lot of my negative attitudes toward other people had come directly from my father. And I didn't even know it. Because I think there's a magical wand or something like that, that they can imprint these little things into your brain without you knowing it. But over and over and over again, I said, oh yeah, that's where that came from. I know that now. And just another positive thing about talking to your parents, even if they don't want to share with you.
Scott?
Yes, sir. Oh boy, I'm okay. I can skip a few things here and get back on track. Once we found out, in large part, why our parents act as they do, the next part is to forgive them. And Norm talks about meditation as one way. But I think his second way is more important, and it's picturing our parents growing up and kind of trying to put yourself in their shoes to see how their upbringing really affected them. I was really lucky in that I got to live in the Midwest where my dad came from, and I went through some of the places he grew up in, and I could see again, oh, that's where that came from, just mirroring his environment. And most of you have heard of the inventory I took as part of my recovery. But I think it's critical to look at our fears and anger and shortcomings really seriously and put them, try to see patterns in them, because there are patterns. And those patterns cause us to do things in a certain way. Some of them are positive and some negative. And we're shooting for the positive, obviously. And another term for that, I was told by my first teacher, was habit energy. It's the same thing as doing the same thing over and over is habit energy. He called it karma. Same thing. And what we really need to do is, if we look at our parents, we look at ourselves for those patterns, we see that we're all people. We're no better and we're no worse than any other person. And even better than that, we're all in this together. And us, our friends, our neighbors, we are all worthy humans, and we are all worthy of forgiveness. But you have to see everybody as a human being on equal status, equal part of yourself. Having other people around us is really kind of a precious thing. They are our fellows. And so we need to really focus on that, on the forgiveness part. If we do that, we fit in with society. We're comfortable with our friends. We're comfortable in our own skin. I don't think there's anything more mature than that. And just remember that forgiveness is like any other activity that we do. If we make a habit of it, it's going to get stronger and stronger the more we do it. And people around us will pick up on it. And I'll summarize. Norm writes in the last part of the chapter, connection to our own suffering is connection to the fullness of life. It brings us to a profound compassion for ourselves and others. The journey of maturity is long, sensitive, and essentially spiritual. It involves responding truly and faithfully to conditions, owning our own experience honestly without being limited by it, and developing the strength and stability to bear life's troubles and the self-acceptance necessary to be able truly to love others. And I don't have any time for a discussion. Does anybody have any questions? Boy. Okay, next time we're going to be talking about chapter 6, meditation as a tool for finding your way to maturity, and on vowing. And the vowing chapter is pretty heavy duty, so you might want to take a pretty good look at that. Thank you.